memoir of Christian Wiman. Have any of you ever heard of Christian Wiman? He is a very celebrated writer. He's the editor of one of the world's most prestigious poetry magazines. And very recently, he became a Christian. In the fine arts world, that is a leopard changing its spots. And the reason why he became a Christian, I thought was very interesting. It was after he fell in love and got married and experienced a joy he never thought possible, and after he was diagnosed with incurable cancer. He recounts in the book that his worldview was incapable of giving him a framework to make sense of such abundance and destitution. He was a poet without a vocabulary capable enough to voice such terror and such grace. But he found both in the vocabulary and framework that surrounds Jesus Christ. I think that's an underappreciated reason why someone might consider the Christian faith. You know, it provides a lexicon of sorts that helps you make sense of life's perplexities. It helps you live more fully into both joy and sorrow. And in a sense, that's what we've been trying to do this Advent. We've told stories of people whose lives were characterized by waiting. People who had dreams but had to wait for their fulfillment. People who were held captive but had to wait for their deliverance. Waiting is an inescapable facet of our lives. Why are we so often forced to assume the posture of waiting? Is there a hidden purpose to it? Might there be a reason for it? Those are the questions we've been exploring, and we've hoped that these stories might provide, if not answers, at least a framework to understand it. Well, the kind of waiting on the docket today is waiting for blessing, waiting for a good thing that God has seemingly withheld. This kind of waiting truly aches. It gets into your bones, and it makes it very difficult to rejoice in anything while you're in the midst of it. This is the ache that barren Hannah experienced in our Old Testament lesson. She's a kind of patron saint for those of us who have suffered God's delay. And I know that her story, the story of waiting for the blessing of a child, is too familiar for some of us. I know that some of us, that is our actual story. And if not actually us, then it's the story of our spouse, our sister, or someone that we love. In fact, because this is such a personal subject, we're actually going to do something a bit different today. I'm going to tell the story of Hannah and explore a bit of what the Bible has to say about this idea of waiting for blessing. But we're also going to hear from Jenny Behrens. Jenny is one of the members of our community, and I think it's going to be very encouraging for us to see how her story parallels Hannah's in a lot of ways. It's a taped interview. I saw some of you looking for Jenny. She will not appear out of the sacristy. Both stories, Jenny and Hannah, they have the same movements, the same chapters. First, there was a bitter pain. And then a simple choice that led to profound joy. A bitter pain and a simple choice. First, a bitter pain. We're told several times that at the outset of our story, Hannah is a very, very miserable woman. In fact, our English translations may even dull the more vivid original. She prayed to the Lord, it says, in deep anguish. It's a piercing pain of the soul. She wept bitterly. It's a word that means to wail, to cry out, even to shriek. In verse 6, we're told that she was provoked she was irritated. That word means to roar with anger. And picture a woman shaking with grief, seething with rage. She wants to have a child desperately, but the Lord has closed her womb. Now, we're all sympathetic with that. We can all relate to that. But to grasp the depths of her pain, we have to understand it a bit in context. Consider, for example, the economics of it. You know, in ancient society, your wealth, your economic status, was oftentimes directly tied to how many children you could have. You could be a baker, a shoemaker, a farmer. It didn't matter. The more children you had, the bigger your workforce was, the more money you were going to make. Fewer children you had, smaller workforce, the more you were going to struggle. And moreover, since only 4 out of 10 children survived into adulthood, your kids were kind of your insurance policy. And there was no social safety net. There were no retirement funds, no social security. When you grow old, you depended upon your kids to care for you. Having them was sometimes literally a matter of life and death. And the women who could have many children, they were heroes. Heroes of their nation, heroes of their tribe, heroes of their family. And women who could not, well, in that world, they were worthless. Worthless in their own eyes. And oftentimes, they were deemed worthless in the eyes of others. Now, put that enormous cultural pressure on top of the very natural desire that many women have to raise a family. When you think about those two things together, you realize that Hannah was forced into almost an idolatry of family and children. They were to her idols, something she could not live without. The cultural system of her day made it nearly inevitable. Here's how one commentator put it. Barrenness in any ancient text or narrative is the effective metaphor for hopelessness. For without children, there was no foreseeable future for yourself, for your family, or for your people. Barrenness meant there was no human power to invent a future at all. Some of you remember that we talked about idolatry a couple weeks ago. And one of the things we said was that an idol is oftentimes a good thing that becomes an ultimate thing. Something we may very well be encouraged to expect and to love under God, but it becomes destructive when we start to love it in place of God. Something as if to say that if we don't have it, we can't imagine a future. I think that's the key to understanding the bitterness of Hannah's pain. She was upset because she wanted to get pregnant and she couldn't. But why was it so grievous? Why did it make her so miserable? Why was it so corrosive in her heart and soul? Well, it's because her natural desire, her good desire to have a family, to raise children, had become an idol. She couldn't imagine a future without it. And when that blessing was withheld, She was miserable. We live in a very different world. We have different values. We have a different cultural system. But it's the same struggle. Our cultural system creates and our hearts entertain idols that seek to unseat God from his rightful place in our lives. And when those idols, those good things that have become ultimate things, when they're withheld, it becomes very bitter and very painful. We cannot imagine a future without them. Now, this is a really easy thing to discuss. This is a very, very challenging thing to go through.
Familiar with Hannah's story for years before I became well acquainted with her pain. My husband, Dean, and I had been in our late 20s, and we had a 14-month-old daughter when we decided to try to grow our family again. And we just always kind of assumed that we would have these kids, two or three or even four, back to back to back. And we loved the role of parenting, and I had even quit my job when Joanna was 18 months old so that I could stay at home with her and all the rest of these babies that we were going to have. But a month turned into a few months, and then a few months turned into a year, and then two, and then three, and we've been experiencing second infertility for 4 years now. And at first, we really were not that worried because we already had one kid and we just thought it would come along naturally, but it didn't, and no doctor could really tell us why. So all of our friends were having their second and third and even fourth babies, and we just felt stunted. We were waiting and waiting on God, and it was a bitter waiting. I felt like this little kid who'd been left at school, and all of our friends had been picked up, and I was just sitting on the curb, watching the road, waiting for God to show up. And it was a really bitter time. My wandering thoughts were always anxious, and I literally felt heartsick. Every pregnancy announcement, every baby shower was a reminder that God was giving everybody else what we desperately wanted, that he was just withholding this simple, common blessing from us.
Well, it gets even more emotional in part two, just to warn you. So Hannah, like we saw Jenny there, was pretty miserable at the beginning of our story. But by the end of the story, if you caught a very significant last line, her face was no longer downcast. What happened? What changed? Hannah made one very simple choice that made all the difference. Did you notice how Peninnah taunted Hannah at the beginning of the story? She said, in effect, I have children and you don't. What are you, Hannah, if you can't have any kids? So cruel. And what it represents is the temptation for Hannah to continue to define her life around the idea of being a person who wants to be a mom but can't, to stay trapped in bitter disappointment, to keep worshiping the idol of motherhood. Well, Hannah's husband offers a way out. With the best of intentions, he comes to Hannah and says, Hannah, I can't even imagine how hard this must be for you. But don't you understand? I love you. I love you. You don't need to be a mom to have significance and worth? You are my beautiful, loving wife. Don't be so upset. It's the best of intentions, but it's another trap. So Hannah looks to her left and she sees the bitter disappointment of wanting to be a mom, but not being able to be a mom. Hannah looks to her right and she sees the promise of a new identity, a new way of finding significance and worth. And it's being around the idea of being a devoted, loving, beautiful husband. Hannah looks to her left, Hannah looks to her right, and Hannah makes a revolutionary decision. She is not going to stay bitter and disappointed because she wants to be a mom and cannot, nor is she going to simply redirect that energy and that frustration around the idea of being a beautiful wife. She realizes that both of those options, both of those ways of finding identity and significance and worth, they are both closed circles. They are traps. They are idols that promise salvation but will always, always fail. So what does Hannah do? What does the text say? Once they had finished eating and drinking, Hannah stood up. And in her deep anguish, she prayed to the Lord. Now, Hebrew narrative is sparse, and sometimes, at least I hope, these incidental details are charged with significance. Hannah looked to her left, and she saw the idol of motherhood. Hannah looked to her right, she saw the idol of matrimony. But Hannah stood up, and she prayed. Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me. Hannah addresses God as the Lord Almighty. It's the infinitely great God, the Lord for whom all the nations of the world are but a drop in the bucket. She stresses God's transcendence. But you notice what Hannah also does. Hannah assumes that her broken heart, a broken heart of a single, barren, obscure woman, matters to this great and awesome God. Hannah realizes that God is infinitely great and infinitely tender at the same time. And she says, remember me. Do not forget me in this time of suffering. We can regard doubt, our anger, our disappointment, our bitterness as obstacles to prayer, reasons why we should avoid God, or we can regard those same emotions as our way into prayer, as what we come to the Lord to talk to him about. That is a very simple decision that we all have to make while we're suffering and waiting for blessing. The choice that we make makes all the difference.
So when the realization that I might never get pregnant again really began to sink in, I knew I had to make a decision. I could let my prayers stay limited to these kind of desperate pleas for God to give us a baby. Please, God, please let it be this month, please. Or I could start to let him transform me, to take those deepest desires and those very real and raw prayers and bring something new out of them and out of me. It was probably about over a year into it when I was reminded of Mary's words. When this angel comes and basically wrecks her life, he tells her that she's going to get pregnant. So she has the opposite problem that I do, but her circumstances are totally different. And in that moment, her picture for her life had to have completely unraveled. Life was not going to look the way Mary thought it would. And Mary's response was, "Let it be to me as you have said." And so that really became my prayer, those three words, "Let it be." Jesus, let this be more to me than what it appears. Let it be more to me. Whatever it is you want to teach me, whatever you want to change in me, whatever you want to take out, let it be. And from that moment on, I listened to the Beatles song on repeat for months and months and months. And I did that because I kind of needed these constant reminders to look to Jesus, to look to Jesus on the cross, to his pain and his suffering, and ultimately the way all of those things were redeemed and reversed. So I did things to remind myself. Like, I just listened to sermons while I was doing the dishes or cleaning around the house. I wrote in a prayer journal all the time, just about that ache and about what I felt. I talked to friends and prayed with them, and they prayed for me, and I prayed for them. I read biographies of Christians who were denied the things that I take for granted, and I read the Bible a lot, and let it encourage me, let the words sink in. And those reminders just kept me focused on Jesus, and that he is always doing something new. He's always taking something bad and flipping it around. God could do that to the cross, to the worst story in the history of humanity, and make it into the most beautiful thing, surely he could do that with my little story. And over time, I really was being transformed. It wasn't something that just like bubbled up naturally in me. It was by God's grace that I was able to choose again and again, every minute sometimes, to pray that prayer, "Let it be." I remember really feeling the weight of this transformation. One time I was talking to a friend, kind of describing how alive I was feeling to God, and I said, literally, "I just feel so fertile right now." We both just kind of stopped, like neither one of us could really believe that I had said those words, but we realized that God was giving me an even better fertility than what I was asking for. This really was better. And it wasn't that I quit praying that I would get pregnant or I didn't want it anymore. I still desperately wanted it, but I wanted him even more than these ideals that I had for my family. Another big turning point for me was this sudden realization, and it really was sudden, that I was not this little kid sitting on the curb waiting for God to come and pick her up. I was waiting, but I was not waiting on God to show up, because God was right there sitting on that curb with me. And it was like he was whispering, "Wait for it, just wait for it." So instead of just sitting there waiting for him to get there, I realized that I was waiting with him for his timing. And that realization that it was like he had this gift for me that he couldn't wait for me to unwrap, but we both just had to wait, really transformed the waiting itself. It gave me so much more anticipation and hope and joy, even in the midst of waiting. But 4 years later, we have a really obvious blessing in our family too. On November 1st of last year, Dean and I began the adoption process, and we met with a social worker so that we could do a home study and even be eligible to adopt. And it took a lot of emotional and financial resources. And we felt like Abraham, like we were setting out and we didn't know where we were going and we didn't know if we would ever even arrive. But exactly 9 months later, to the very day from our first meeting with the social worker, our son Winston was born. And we got to be there for the delivery, and we got to take him home that same weekend. And he is such a blessing. and his story is such a blessing. But even if our family had stayed the same size, I would still characterize this season as a blessing. A blessing in disguise, not without heartache and grief, but ultimately a blessing. Because of this whole experience, I really have experienced his love as something that does not fail us. He never stops working things for good. He never stops redeeming them or reversing them. He just never stops. And our pain and our suffering is real, and it can be so loud sometimes, but it does not have the final word. He does. And at the very end of it all, he will not leave us disappointed.
Such an amazing story. Both Jenny's and Hannah's story are amazing. You know, pictures of Christians or people of God, pictures of women who are free from the idols of their culture, whose deepest desires have been transformed, and because of that, they are untouchable. They're untouchable. Nothing can throw them off center and corrode their inner life. But the temptation is to say, oh, that's so amazing. I can't do that. I could never do that. If that was me in Jenny's shoes, I would have stayed angry. I would have stayed trapped in disappointment. But that is where you're wrong. That is where you're wrong. And you know why? It's something Jenny hints at in the video. And it's something also that Hannah hints at, not in our text, but in the next chapter, in another one of her prayers to the Lord. Here's what Hannah says. My heart rejoices in the Lord, and in the Lord my horn or my strength is lifted high. The Lord brings death, and the Lord makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. What's she saying? Hannah is saying that the God that we serve, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, is a God who reverses things. He's a God who reverses things. A God who lifts the needy from the ash heap and has them sit upon a throne of royalty. Did you know that when Jesus Christ suffered, he was crucified outside the city gates? It wasn't at the center of town. It was out near the town dump, where everyone burned their trash into a smoldering ash heap. Why? Because God reverses things. God reverses things. Jesus went down into the ash heap so that he could lift us up and sit with him in the heavenly places. Now, did Hannah know that? Did Hannah really know that God reversed things? That God would take the bitterness of her suffering and would bring out of it the sweetness of life and salvation? I don't know. We don't really know if Hannah grasped that fundamentally. But you and I have something that Hannah never had. We have the cross. We have an indisputable sign that God brings life out of death, that God brings salvation out of suffering. You know what that means? It means that Jenny can say, even if my family would have stayed the same size, I would still characterize this season as a blessing. It means that the ancient world was wrong, that barrenness does not equal forsakenness. It means that you do not have a future. It means that you do have a future if you still cannot have kids. It means, this is what it means. It means that if we are faithful to God, if we do not capitulate and give in to our cultural idols, but if we stay faithful to God, then God will take our suffering and he will turn it into gold. He will turn it into gold for you, and he will turn it into gold for the people that you love. So are you suffering right now? Of course you're suffering right now. For something. It may be something very little. It may be something huge. Maybe you're waiting for fulfillment. Maybe you're waiting for deliverance. Or maybe you're waiting for a blessing. Maybe you're waiting for a child. Stand up. Stand up. Go to God. Pray. He will take your suffering and he will turn it into gold. That's what Hannah's story teaches us. That's what Jenny's story teaches us. And that's what the child whose birth we are about to celebrate screams at us. Let's pray.